Hello and welcome to session 39 of the One Love Art Sessions, Dedication. I'm James LJ.
I'm Crespo.
And I'm Jose. And today we wanted to talk about dedication with one of our friends from across the pond. But before we get into that, we wanted to talk a little bit, as we always do, about current events, news items. It's hard to miss one of the biggest news items in the world right now, which is the current conflict that's going on in Ukraine. But we wanted to kind of talk about all of the different efforts that are being directed towards the people, you know, sort of relief efforts, especially in the art world. A lot of the different artist communities that we're part of, the NFT community, they are have been kind of banding together to bring relief to the Ukrainian people, and more specifically supporting Ukrainian artists. So I don't know what you guys have seen across your scopes.
Yeah, what I've seen is just further evidence of like that aspect of community, right? How artists are coming together and using our abilities for some type of social good. And we saw this right in the Black Lives Matter movement. But it's weird, right? Because during the Black Lives Matter movement, it was more like we're talking about murals, the panel paintings on the boarded up windows and the street art. But this time around, it's a lot more of the digital art, which now it's like evidence of the evolution and the immediacy of how this how we can use art as a tool for change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think overall, even beyond art, technology has been used to kind of funnel money over there to ensure that people are, you know, are okay, right? So, you know, that's this idea of digital connection, digital currency, digital commerce, in stages like this, in situations like this, take center stage because it shows you how key technology is. One of my first jobs out of college was for a nonprofit digital giving platform that actually was created due to 9/11. So when 9/11 happened, and it's crazy to think about that, people had no way to donate, like beyond sending checks and giving money to places like Red Cross and all these areas. So due to 9/11, there was a big push to create platforms where people can connect and give online. And so it's kind of a full circle, right? So this idea of, we never think about that, but the idea of connecting online via like commerce, mm-hmm. obviously it's become big because of shopping, but it really was the crux of it was during times of turmoil, the ability for people to connect and have transactional relationships and help people was really where the internet took center stage, and it continues to, right? This is where innovation starts to come into play, right? We always see when things like this happen, you see innovation in the sense of, okay, this is how it was before, but now there's a dire need. How do we change this up so that we can adjust to that need, right? And then for the next few months, you're going to see those innovations kind of start to spiral to other areas, right? Even looking at something like Airbnb, the fact that people are going and renting Airbnbs from people, but not even looking to stay there, but just so that they can funnel money into the system. So it's another right. idea of how do we take the internet and use it for social good beyond, you know, I'm just going to go on the internet and I'm going to give money. So people are just, the innovation and the creativity beyond just making art is definitely yeah. amazing at this point.
And also more direct kind of payments, right? So instead of necessarily giving to a foundation or an organization that then has to disperse those funds, you could give to one specific person who is in need, like this yeah. this one-to-one, the peer-to-peer kind of connection.
Definitely.
You definitely have more control of where your money's going, and you can actually see how it's helping people directly rather than it go to, say, a charity and it's got various offshoots. But yeah. I think right. there's more control and you can keep track of it.
And they also have fees related to, so the full amount doesn't necessarily go.
Right. Well, I want to turn the conversation a little bit. And I want to speak about something that we talked about in our last episode. We were talking about influential artists that have impacted our individual careers and our artwork. And Jose, you mentioned Jose Clemente Orozco, which is one of the big muralists from Mexico.
Right.
And I was at the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, last weekend, and I was just walking around, you know, looking at all the exhibits. Oh, and by the way, it's so easy to take for granted, like, the museums that you have in your city, because you just live so close to them, you forget like how cool it is to just stop in. I had a chance to walk through and really pay attention to what someone was going. I wasn't in a rush, you know, it was just, I was alone. And I came across this piece that it was striking, you know, and it was like three men that were sitting in a subway cart. And I couldn't pin the style. I was looking at it and I couldn't figure out like who the artist was. So I like to try to figure it out ahead of time. But then eventually I read the artist statement, and it was done by Jose Orozco Clemente. And in the caption, it says that he spent some time in New York City and was never able to make it as an artist. This guy is one of the most profound international muralists. But the time he spent in New York City, which is supposed to be one of the cities that art is found and, you know, well, it's just a place, right? It's just a place for art. And he couldn't make it here. And so I wanted to have a conversation real quick with you guys about how you feel location plays a role in an artist's success.
I think New York in general, it definitely has always been a melting pot for art, but it also has been a rough area across the board, right? So every major, well, until currently where everything is more modernized, but when you think about the very gritty New York art scene, it was always who you know, how you survived. There's even if you're not an artist, there's an art to surviving in New York City, and it's not for everyone, right? Like, you need to be able to make it day by day. You know, still talking about the gritty New York art scene, like, these people were like living in tenements and like not knowing where their food is going to come from. Like, that's like, it's a crazy artist lifestyle. And not to say that he wasn't built for that, but it's a certain type of person that can thrive and make those connections. And it's not so much where like, oh, I'm going to come to New York and I'm going to be an artist and I'm going to be famous. It's really like, yeah, but everyone here is an artist. Like, why are you different?
Right. I should add before anybody else adds in, he was showing too. He was like exhibiting work. So it wasn't that he was just like painting and trying to sell. Mm-hmm. That's amazing to me. So he was in the scene, but it just wouldn't click.
Interesting.
Jose, that's your point, man. What you think?
To bring it back to kind of like digitization, right? So think of this. First of all, what really struck me is how long ago that painting was. You showed it to me, and I was like, I didn't even know that subways were around that long. It was like the 1920s or something. I forget. So just seeing that it existed at that point, but why couldn't he break in? So New York had a lot of, I'm sure the art world had a lot of, what's the word, gatekeepers, right? That's something that we always have.
Yeah.
So I'm sure he had the same kind of gatekeepers, and the same gatekeepers exist now too in like the virtual world, right? Right. Mm-hmm. You could be established in one area in the fine arts, and then you find yourself trying to go into a more digital area, and you know, you haven't made it. So they're probably like, well, the same thing. It's like, well, okay, you were an established artist, but what makes you different? What makes you special? And you need to spend the time in that space and grind before you're actually accepted.
So there's no guarantee. Talking about paying dues. Don't tell me you're talking about paying dues again.
So what you're saying is that he would have struggled to get Unknown Origin?
I think so. Oh, yeah. Totally.
They would have put him on.
I've never gotten on Super Rare. Absolutely not.
No nifty gateway drops for him.
No.
Lee, before you answer, it's going to play a role later in the conversation. So I want you to hold back the answer, because we're going to ask you about your specific location and how it's played a role in your career as well.
Okay, cool.
So let's do that. Jay, what are we talking about today? What are we looking at?
So we are talking about dedication. I'm not going to go a deep dive of my usual. These are the four definitions of dedication. I'll throw you one, which is obviously the quality of being dedicated or committed to a task or purpose. I say that one because I always find it funny when I look up a definition of a word and like part of the word is in the definition. Because like, if you really didn't know what the word meant, you would be like, that's not helpful. Like, dedication is part of being dedicated. Like, thanks. Thanks, Webster. But we all know what dedication is. We all know that dedication comes in many forms. You know, you're dedicated to your family, dedicated to your career, dedicated to your art, dedicated to your passions, your focus, your muse. It can play many roles. And I think in this realm, talking about dedication as artists, oftentimes it can be really easy to stay dedicated to what you're doing. And sometimes it can be really hard, right? We were just talking about making it in the New York art scene, right? That's one of those scenarios where being dedicated to a goal can be really tough, right? When you make things, right? So when you make something, that's your heart, that's your soul, and you put it out there and people are like, that's cool. Like, it's really easy to not be dedicated anymore and be like, okay, fine, dad, I'm gonna go be a lawyer because this art thing didn't work out. So, you know, dedication can play many forms, and I think it's really, really important in the art world and as artists. It plays an integral role in whether or not you make it to the end.
Yeah, I agree there, actually. It's funny, dedication isn't really sort of a thing you can define, is it? It is, it's more of a feeling. Like, it's something you just do. There's no way to actually define it. You just have to... It's basically grinding and getting on with something and just constantly doing it. It's not really it's kind of relentless at what you do, and nothing is getting in the way. I don't know how you lose that. I find whenever I've been painting for so long, like years and years and years, I've always done it. I've done it every day, every single day, drawing and painting every single day. But it's a passion. It is a feeling, it's an emotion, it's a passion to do something rather than like I want to get from this to this. It's just something you have to do.
Jose, you think of something, man?
Well, it reminded me of what first I think we need to give Lee a proper intro.
Yeah, we should. let's get this thing going. Yeah, and because we definitely want him to be full on part of this conversation. So Lee Ellis is an artist based in the UK. I crossed paths with him through our KO community. I won't brag too.
What's KO?
Yeah, I should explain that first. So Known Origin is one of the curatorial platforms that we are minting and collecting our NFTs on. And the community has a pretty good way of keeping us in contact and crossing paths and allowing us to build with one another. So I was able to cross paths with Lee, really explore his artwork. I became a fan of his artwork. I'm a fan of your work. And, you know, I'll stop there so that you can give us a proper introduction, as Jose said. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm a Bristol-based artist and designer. So I've spent the last 12 years or so as a graphic designer, sort of art director for various design agencies. Alongside that, I've always been painting, printmaking, drawing, you name it, I've done it. And I'm at the point now where I'm just trying to focus on constantly painting.
And I paint. How did you get to that decision? Portraits. So like you have, jack of all trades. It seems like you can do a little bit of a lot. So what drew you specifically to focus on painting?
So I went to art college, did a foundation course in art and tried loads of different things and then focused on design and did a degree of design. The moment I graduated, I realized I don't like sticking to briefs and I wanted some freedom. And so I started, I started painting, and I had a flat that I shared with two mates at the time. And I just one day started to pick up a brush and started throwing paint around. I ended up selling my bed, ripping up the carpet, and basically living at my girlfriend's, who's now my wife, thankfully. And I turned it into a studio. I lost my deposit completely on that flat because I was a horrible tenant. It was the worst. I had to redecorate.
You mean the landlord couldn't just take the white and just kind of white it off?
I think it was more the fact that I'd sold some furniture to fund my painting habit that didn't go down so well. Yeah, that was, it was a horrible flat as well. And so it was from then, really, that I just loved that freedom of painting and paint whatever I wanted. I sort of built up a collection of, it was mostly shit, to be fair, paintings that I had to then try and sell. I used to go down to the, there's a harbour side in Bristol, and I would sit on the waterfront and just try and flog, try and sell off all the pieces I had. So it was quite, I don't know, stereotypical artist, you know, just sitting in on the street trying to flog your wares.
You were shilling, just, old school shilling.
old school shilling. Yeah. and from there, I've just carried on like every day, every single day. I got various design jobs, which was good because, you know, obviously at that time, art wasn't going to pay my rent. So did design, and every day when I got home, I'd paint and I'd just constantly work at it. And I still do that. Like, I paint and draw every day. Like, I've got a new sketchbook with me now.
Amazing.
Just started the scribbling. Yeah.
You know, if I could jump in here right here. So initially, when I first started following you on Twitter, you know, there's like, there's these big trust and like building of narratives that happen on social media, right? You want to know, like, I wonder if this person is actually doing this. Me post work every single day, and like throughout the day while he's working, he'll like, it seems like a roller coaster. It's like, oh, I have these new pieces I'm about to mint. I'm gonna burn all this shit. Then it's like, this piece was terrible. And then by the end of, you know, his last post is like, okay, these pieces are available now. And I'm like, how did we just followed your entire like day? And is it really like that? Is that, are you working like that?
Most of the time. Wow. It's been a bit quieter lately because I'm looking after my youngest. Well, he's actually starting preschool this week, full time.
Wow. Cool.
So it's kind of slowed down a bit, but all of last year, like, I was freelancing for most of it, but they didn't give me briefs on time. So I would just go in my studio, which I built at the end of a garden, and just paint. And when I'm in the studio just doing that, it's quite relentless. I'm the most destructive creative you can ever imagine. Like, I will destroy anything. If it's not working, it just gets painted over, gets burned, gets chopped up.
Yeah, that's great. That's great self-awareness, right? You don't feel too tied down to any of your.
It's a little bit wasteful, but it's also it helps me evolve, and it does feel quite good when you've done something. It's not working. You paint over it, or you chopping it up or burning it is quite extreme, but it does feel good. It's cathartic.
Listen, time is valuable, right?
Yeah,
don't waste time on stuff that's not working out.
Yeah, that happened the other day. I did a massive piece. It was a meter by a meter 20. So that's what, 3 foot by 3.5 foot roughly. So I'd spent a few days working on this piece, and I just couldn't get it working. And I was about to put a load of oil paint onto it and realized that it just wasn't going to work. So I whitewashed the whole lot, which was brutal, because as I started it, the original piece, I quite liked it. And then it just got shitter as the time went on. So I had to get rid of it.
I have a quick question. Do you ever take pictures in between? Like, is photography part of your process at all, where you kind of like, you take a photo in process to kind of like capture it, remember it?
I do, but it's mainly so that I can, when I'm not in the studio, I can look at it and try and figure out what I want to do. Or I post it on social media just so, you know, it shows I'm working.
Right. proof of work.
It doesn't, yeah. It mainly helps me evolve it rather than me go back and
got it.
Look how nice it was at that point.
That's fine.
So I sometimes scribble. So
nothing's
on my phone.
Precious.
No.
It's like me. Yesterday, I took a photo of like one of my son's artwork that he brought back from school that I knew we were just never going to keep. So I was like, okay, let me take a picture of it, remember it. And then I threw it away. But I didn't throw it away well enough, and he found it.
Good. Like, I was going to tell him too. I was going to wait till his 12th birthday. I was going to tell him that shit.
He found it in the trash. He's like, Daddy, why did you throw this away? He's like, you found it. Oh, I'm so glad. Let's put this on the fridge right now.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. Surely he must have been broken.
No. We switched it real quick. We saved that.
When you just brought up the kids' artwork, I was like, oh, I've been meaning to ask you guys, because we have upstairs like just a stack in a folder of all like the artwork that he brings back from daycare. And I was about to ask you guys, like, you know, what do you do with this stuff? Like, cause we want to like keepsake it. And then you were like, and then I threw it away. So I'm not going to ask you for advice.
So in my case, my son, his favorite place to create art, no matter how I have all his stations set up, right? He has a sculpture space. He has his painting space. He has his easel set up, but his dry erase board is all he really cares about. So for my son, like the longevity of his project is almost unimportant to him. He just wants to be able to do and then move on. And so occasionally he'll mention like, oh yeah, I created that, you know, cup of hot cocoa craft in daycare, but he doesn't really like look for it or anything. It was just like a memory for him. Like, oh, I did that, you know, but he just likes the practice of it.
So it's more the process. He likes the process, but he loves the process. He's fussed about the results.
Yeah. No. He's more like Lee, right? Yeah. He's like, I don't like this. Yeah.
He's yeah. like Lee. He is. Lee, you create with your kids too. You do, right?
Yeah. So my eldest is four. By the way, I keep most of his drawings. I've got an A1 size plan chest. So I have a whole drawer. It's massive, filled with his drawings. Okay. Yeah. I quite like him.
Good for you.
But so Jay, you want to talk to Lee about this. Yeah, not Jose.
I was like, when he brought it up, he was like, oh, he brought the artwork home. And I'm like, oh, I've been meaning to ask you guys. And then it just took like a left turn. He was like, yeah, threw it out. Like, wait, what?
I heavily curate. actually, because
talk about a gatekeeper.
Yeah,
right. In fact, nothing goes on his fridge.
Right.
But magnets.
He told his kid, "We are sorry to inform you that while your work shows promise,
please be look out on the next portfolio review date."
I love the idea of you sending him an actual letter to say that. I'm sorry, your work is rejected at this point. In answer to your question, yes, I create with my eldest. So I get massive paper and I usually put it on my studio floor. Sometimes I set the camera up to do a time lapse.
Okay.
And it's very fortunate, really. I have a bag of professional marker pens and I just give him those and then I play with charcoal. So I'm doing a charcoal drawing whilst he's using the markers. And then sometimes we switch and it's really nice. It's really refreshing because he can just let loose. And I find, sounds a bit cheesy really, but I find I learn quite a lot from him because he's so free with it, which is, I think Picasso once said like that, something about creativity in children and it's trying to stay a child as you grow up. You'll probably find the quote, he would have said it much better than I just did. but it is quite nice to see where he can just go nuts with and make marks that you would never think to do because you're so rigid as an adult when you're trying to do that. You're trying to make a shape. Yeah.
Pure, and, very pure.
So marking. I quite like that. Yeah, it's lovely to do and to be able to do. I feel really fortunate I can do that. And I'm looking forward to my 2-year-old being able to do it as well.
That's amazing.
He's a menace, so that'll be a while.
How many showings of Encanto are you up to now? Because we went back and forth on Twitter, and I told you that I was up to 6 a day.
Wow. It's not that bad, but I think I could recite the entire film.
I can write the whole screenplay.
Yeah, it's a very popular film at the moment.
Can we stay on the topic of kids? Would you mind? Because I just started listening to Dave Grohl, the drummer, the lead of Nirvana, you know. He just came out with a book, I forget how long ago, and he was talking about his kids, right? And how he found it inevitable that his daughter would start drumming. And then, of course, she was great. She was like a natural. So do you see that sort of in your own kids? Like that they've taken your creative kind of genes or your creative expression?
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily sort of genes. I think they're exposed to that creativity. So they have those sort of the space to just try stuff. And I think by doing that, they are learning and they are like my son, who's four, he's really good at colouring in, like really good. He stays within the line. He's way better than I am. But I think it's just from that being exposed to that process of colouring and drawing, he can be creative and he has, you know, you see potential. Also, as a parent, you're biased. Like, as far as I'm aware, like, I'm concerned, my children are geniuses. So
that's great. That's beautiful. And also, Crespo, I know your son is really good work.
Like Lee said, you know, it's fortunate that you were able to provide your child with these more professional level markers and charcoal. You know, I could do the same thing, right? As an art teacher, I have an abundant amount of materials where my son can explore more than just, you know, crayons and or the glue and pasting that he might do inside of his class. So yeah, I'm a big proponent for families using creativity in any capacity with their children. So when you talk about a drum, you know, the drummer story, that's impressive to me too. And yeah. All right. What I want to do is I want to get back into this guy's story because it's important. It's important to me.
Yeah. So Lee, before we came on, we spoke about it. I have one of your pieces. I think, you know, whether you're talking about your paint on canvas or your digital stuff, your style is very unique. It's identifiable. Like, you can look at something and be like, yeah, that's a Lee Ellis. How would you, I know how I would, but how would you describe your style?
Firstly, it's really nice to hear that. Like, yeah, reassuring. How would I describe my style? Frantic, mostly, and expressive. I've never had to define it. I think the best way would be, it's experimental. Everything I do is an experiment. I'm constantly experimenting. I'm painting with things that you ordinarily wouldn't paint with. So like tile adhesives, applicators and wire brushes. So it's all about experimentation. And I think that's probably the best way to describe it. It has elements of macabre and also kitsch because it's bright colors. And there's no sort of genre it fits in, I don't think. But yeah, I'm open to suggestions, by the way. So. Yeah.
Well, one of the greatest things about this podcast is that it's an opportunity for all of us to learn. So, you know, even understanding here, talking about dedication, what that looks like to each one of us may be slightly different. And we're getting some insight into what you're doing. So I agree with Jay. Your work is completely identifiable. And I want to talk about two things. The first I want to hear a little bit about is you have an IRL show going on right now in real life. You have a show going on. Yeah. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I've got my first major solo show in London going on now. It opened last Thursday. It's a selection of 25 portraits and 6 abstracts. It's called Appetite for Disruption, which is
cool.
It came to me it was in the middle of the night. I woke up. Well, I think my youngest had woken up. I couldn't get back to sleep. So when that happens, I often come up with really stupid titles for paintings. And that popped into my head. And I was like, oh, that's quite cool. So I wrote it down and used that for the show title. It kind of summed up the work because it is all quite disruptive. Yeah, that's on at the moment. And so far, so good.
Were you able to attend the opening?
I was.
What was that like?
So I went. It was great. I get really nervous about any openings. Even talking to you guys now, I was like nervous beforehand.
Just oh man,
talking, you know, just
right.
Yeah. So I was. I got to London and there was a tube strike. So that meant mission to get to our hotel and then to the gallery. And because of that, and the fact that sort of millions of people use the tube, the underground for getting around London, loads of people cancelled. So I was already thinking no one's going to turn up. And then I felt really shitty and sick the whole time, nervous. And then when I turned up, it was actually really busy and it was lovely to speak to people about the work and people that I'd spoken to online but never met. And it was really refreshing, actually, because it's been a long time since I've had like a proper opening night.
That's what I was fascinated by. You know, as soon as you started mentioning that you were working on the pieces for the exhibition, I was really excited for you. I was excited for us as artists, right? Because that to me, we have, and we'll talk about it in a moment, but you know, we had the digital art market going on, but I still feel very connected to the traditional art market, and the exhibitions and openings are very dear to my heart. It's just another way where we can connect, another way where we could show like the power of art, and for, you know, for artists who are depending on it. I mean, that's livelihood, right? That's how you eat, is at these kind of events. And so
absolutely,
I was really excited for you. Here's my second question. You have an artist series going on where you're paying an ode to some of our greats. Can you tell us a little about that?
So again, that's for another gallery that I'm trialing in May. So they're a UK-based commercial gallery. So they're quite big. And they chose, I gave them a selection of work and they chose various styles that they like. And so I am trying to recreate stuff they like, but I thought artists, I really wanted to do it. I wanted to paint portraits of artists. And I had the idea years ago, and someone I was working with just said, poo-pooed the idea. They just said, no one's going to be interested in that. So I've just done it anyway. And it's just a fun project. Again, everything I do is usually just for me, my own entertainment. So I paint Batman a lot because I find it entertaining.
Who are some of the artists that you've created? I know you had trouble with the Picasso one for a bit, right? Is that the one you still have trouble?
Yeah, that one now is actually, the title of that is going to be Prince Philip doing an impression of Picasso as played by Ed Harris, because he looks like a combination of those three people and looks nothing like Picasso. It's the same. Actually, all of them look, they don't really look like them, because once I start, I get carried away. Most of the time I end up putting elements of me in there. So unfortunately, Frida Kahlo has my nose. I think it was Dali. Did a portrait of Dali, and it doesn't look like Dali. His mustache does, but that's about it.
You should do a whole series of just every person, but they all look like Ed Harris.
I quite like that idea. I think John Malkovich did a series of photographs where he was playing different people. So he played. Oh. I did a photograph of himself as Andy Warhol, Marilyn Monroe. Okay. The Joker is played by Jack Nicholson. Mm-hmm. Sounds kind of similar to that, but I quite like the idea.
There you go.
Yeah.
So Lee, we wanted to ask, what has your experience been in the NFT market, and how has it varied from the traditional art market that you've been experiencing?
Firstly, they're two very different markets. So a traditional art collector obviously puts value on the physical piece, and I find the NFT collectors not so much. I've even offered physical pieces with the work, and it's something I actually want to progress with. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they're just not interested, which I find really peculiar. The space.
Do you feel offended?
I feel like it's their loss, because I'm just going to sell that piece to someone else, which I didn't want to do, because I want to keep everything sort of
tied together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a very unusual space, the NFT space. I still don't fully understand what I'm doing or why I'm doing it, but I'm giving it a go. Everyone seems really nice, though, or at least the people that I'm interacting with. But the joys of social media is you only interact with people that you really want to and have the same general ethos. So a lot of artists, less so the collectors. It's just a very unusual space, because I just can't get my head around it, and how the traditional art world, I'm more drawn to that because I've always been part of that. And I like how a physical piece is valued, and I'm still trying to figure it out. I'm very confused by it all, if you can't tell.
I'm interested in how you got like, how did you get involved because of your affiliation with the traditional art market? Like, I, you know, who was it, somebody, or was it just research? Like, what got you into NFTs?
About 4 years ago, a collector came to my house to pick up some artwork, and he was telling me all about Ethereum and all of that. And he gave me all the resources to join in, and I didn't, which was really silly because I think ETH was worth like a few dollars a coin at the time. Sure. But I only just had like a 6-week-old baby. So my priorities were different. So I kind of forgot about it. And then January last year, it started popping up. Like I just read a load of articles. And then a friend of mine also, he's on Twitter quite a lot doing his NFTs, and he's called Mo75, worth checking him out. He told me about it. He said, I'm thinking about doing it. So because it was still lockdown here, we couldn't actually meet up. So we were doing a Zoom call. He only lives about 15 minutes down the road. So his Zoom call just to talk about NFTs. And I think I did. So March last year was the first time I sort of got into it properly. So I minted a few pieces. They were shit, purely digital, just because I wanted to try it. Right. So I thought I'd just try it. And I think I sold a GIF for about £12, which is not very much, by the way. And then I don't know what happened. I kind of just rethought it and decided, why am I trying to do something that some purely digital just drivel when I could use what I have and evolve that? And so from that moment, I kind of evolved the work that I had, the traditional physical pieces. Sometimes I tweak them in Photoshop and added digital elements, but typically they're as is. They're scans of or photographs of the work. And I started doing that, and I got an invite onto Foundation, and that kind of took off from there. So I was on Rarible originally, and that's where I made the rubbish sale, and that's the only thing since on Rarible. And yeah, from Foundation just kind of went with it. But it was a friend encouraging me to do it, really, that actually spurred me on. Because if I was just doing it by myself, it was too daunting. There's too much going on, and it's so confusing because you've got different people with different opinions everywhere, and it's trying to judge what's right.
I'm sure this is a conversation that the four of us are it's ongoing in our minds, but you're also putting work on the Tezos blockchain as well, right?
Yeah, I started a few weeks ago.
And what's that been like?
Slow.
Yeah.
Slow. And I don't mean to bring it back to money, but not very profitable compared with Ethereum. Like, It's very different.
I think I speak to Jose about this kind of often. For me, the Tezos marketplace is interesting because it's, first of all, it's very easy to collect, right? So you could get carried away collecting because of how affordable it is. But also there's like a little bit of an ego check, because you could be on Ethereum and sell a piece for $400, let's just say, you know, roughly $400. And then, but you can't move a $3 piece on the Tezos blockchain. And you're like at an absolute loss because you're completely convinced that it's like, oh, people do appreciate me. But why do they appreciate me at $400 but not $4? It's a weird place to be.
Yeah, I agree. And it's frustrating to see, isn't it? So I've created like 25 these things, charcoal drawings, loads of them, absolutely loads. So I scanned them in, and I sold a couple on OpenSea, but I just got fed up with them. So I burnt the rest of the series. And then a few days ago, thought, oh, I might sell them as additions on Object. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'll be affordable. And then I can, when the collection or the editions are sold out, I can then choose a collector at random to send the physical to. I thought that was quite a nice way of still getting the work out there. And it's affordable, but sold one. I think I sold one piece so far out of
bringing 25. It back to Orozco not being able to make it in New York, right? I'm doing so well over here on ETH. Yeah. Why can't I make it on Tezos? What's wrong with me?
It's so confusing though, because you see people like selling frequently on there, and I don't know how they're doing it. And I don't know if it's just a lack of audience on Twitter or Discord. Or by the way, I hate Discord. Discord is the worst.
Finally, someone said it. It's all consuming.
I want to do it, and then it's too much.
Discord is just too many conversations going on, and it took me like 4 hours just to change my settings so that I wasn't inundated with direct messages, or like if someone put at here, I would get all those. I was just
And God forbid you click something like bad, right? And then all your money's gone somehow.
Discord is the digital communication equivalent of the dog sitting in the fire. It just says, this is fine. This is fine. And then everything is burning around him. That's what Discord is for me.
Yeah, I think that's a good description, actually. Everyone seems to be on it as well. And I don't know why. Like, it's too many conversations. You can't flow. There's no conversation flow. You can't actually keep track of anything. And it's just relentless. Just like the worst of Twitter in one space.
Right. And I feel like there's always an expectation as an artist to open up your own Discord. That's like the next level. It's like, okay, I've made it here. Now I have to open up a Discord because I need to bring my community in together in one place so that we can talk. But that's not for everybody, right? Not everyone's trying to, you know, manage.
I tried setting up a Discord and I got 4 people to follow it. One of them is me.
and even you left.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Now you're probably like those poor 3 other people. I've let them down.
There is nothing going on there. It's fine.
Good. So there you go. It's fine. And everything is burning. It's fine.
Yeah.
I have no intention of starting one. Jose, in the future, are you going to have an Ojeda's Bodega Discord?
I don't want one. It looks daunting. It looks impossible to keep up.
Yeah.
Are you finding, as artists, like, you're expected to create roadmaps and offer utility for your NFTs? Because I find that very confusing as well. That's why I'm trying to bundle my physical works with the NFTs so that that is like the utility that's where it's going.
Right.
That's where the space is now. I feel like everyone's talking about the PFPs and, or, you know, when you come into the NFT space, you know about the apes and the punks and all these things. So like, being that those are like the headliners right now, it feels like people have some association of that's what success looks like. And I think it's caused other artists to follow that. And not only artists, like you also have just a lot of technical people in the space, right? That are just not artists by trade, but they know how to code, so they can create art based on their knowledge, which still makes them artists. So I think everything is just so crazy up in the air right now. And there is, for artists that may not have, you know, art that's based on utility or any of that, this, they feel like they need to, because other people are like, well, this is what success looks like, and you're not doing that. So I definitely felt like that at certain points. I think at the very minimum, if I would say the only thing that I think every artist should strive to do to be successful in the NFT space, which you do very well, is to be genuine and human being, right? To have people understand that, like, this is not a machine that's creating this. This is a person. This is who I am. And I think at the end of the day, when the smoke clears, that's what people are going to appreciate, right? It's that relationship with the artist. And even when you have these utilities and Discords, you always have people that go in there and it's like, but who's the artist here? They just know that's at the core of everything. No matter what the person is offering, they want to know there's an actual person behind it and who that person is. And the first red flag is when you can't find that, right? When you're just like, I have no, there's no name here. It's just like an avatar. This is very sketchy.
Yeah, and I think having that human, human relationship is really important between artists and artists, between artists and collectors. It doesn't matter who, just being a nice person, just don't be a dick and be yourself. I think that's a good ethos for life, not just the NFT space. Mm-hmm.
Jose, you've been in the NFT space longer than James and myself, but what's your feeling about roadmaps and utility as a collector? Because you've been collecting for a bit now.
It's interesting. I want to talk about the PFP thing and sort of the pressure of needing to follow the crowd or follow what the trend is. I think of countless artists who have, I don't know if they were pressured or encouraged to create PFP projects, right? Like whatever their art, they're painters, they're digital artists. And all of a sudden they're like, well, I guess I need to make 5,000 of these. And that's when, usually when they get their momentum after their PFP thing, and then they blow up and now you're stuck as like this PFP artist. It's kind of like a trap. But in terms of utility, I think you attract your collectors, right? And so you don't need to worry that you're not attracting everyone. It's like if you want to create these paintings, these one-of-ones, or if you want to make editions, or if you want to make PFPs, then you should do that. And you're going to attract that crowd. And you should just forget about the noise, essentially. So being very genuine to yourself.
I think that's a good point, actually, just doing what you want to do, what you love, and trying to block out everyone else. It's so easy to get distracted and directed down a route that you absolutely don't really want to do.
And unfortunately, the distractions largely come because of financial incentive, because when you're here, you want to make money, because making money means that you're providing value, or you're selling, or you're an active participant. You're successful if you've made money. And sometimes the easiest way to make money is through a large edition or large PFP or something.
Yeah. I think in processing this question and watching other artists speak about it, for me, I think like one of one and a small edition artist, I don't think we have an obligation to provide an additional utility. There's an artist in Brooklyn named Jason Naylor, and he speaks about this often whenever he's in spaces. He always finds a way to mention it, but he essentially says that, the sentiment, the feeling that you get from having this piece of art, from looking at this piece of art, is the utility. Like that's it. Like that's the thing that we are providing with you, providing to you as the artist. Yep. But those bigger projects, those PFP projects, I think that demand of what you're expecting from your collector, whether it's the amount of money or the engagement, constantly asking like, oh, let me see your, let's see your PFP, let's create this thread. And like that constant, I think you do have to give them something in return. And I think especially like big corporations who drop like collections, I think right off the back, you owe something to your collector. So like what the Hundreds are doing, or what Staples is doing, they have people coming in, but these are established companies who are already on the side of success. I think if you're expecting more people to invest in you, then I think you have to put them in a position where there is additional value to collecting your artwork, whether it's, access, whether it's garments or some other physical pieces. Yeah, that's where I'm at.
Yeah. And they're very different in that sense too, right? Because if you're a Hundreds or something like that, like, you have a social department, you have a marketing department, you have a sales department. Like, there's no reason why you can't have people dedicated to advancing whatever you're doing, right? Versus like one artist who, again, this everything's on fire, like in a Discord trying to explain why, I'm sorry, like I told you guys I was gonna get something out in February, like, but my kid's been sick, and like, and everyone's like, but you said your roadmap said February 3rd, and they're like, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it's brutal. I've seen people like lead down depression trying to keep up with the horde.
Yeah.
See, that's not that, we don't want that. That's not, well, at least from my perspective, that's not the point of what we're doing here, right? If this underlying like community and support system is supposed to be the driving force of this all, then it should just be understanding that each one of us as an artist is different, and what we can provide and what we need is also different.
Yeah. I saw one artist when I went to their Discord, their roadmap was, I make art, you buy it, we are both happy. That was the
roadmap. I think that's a really good one.
Yeah. And listen, if it's not
that
for
should
you,
be every artist.
Yeah.
If you don't want to get on this road, then listen, take another road.
It's another road. There's always that alternate route on Google Maps. You choose that other one. I want to bring this conversation full circle. We spoke about dedication. We had a chance to kind of define it. But I think that what we want to know is really what keeps you going? You know, what's made you so dedicated to your craft?
Really good question. I think I'm always on the hunt for the thing that is what I want, you know, like the magnus opus, like my masterpiece. And I'm nowhere near that. And I think that's the drive. And also, I don't do anything else. This is what I love. Like, it's turned into my work, but it's still my passion and my hobby. Mm-hmm. I do it all the time. Like, there's nothing else I want to do. And so I'm just going to keep doing that. And I'm never retiring. I'm going to be 100. Yeah, I'm going to be 100 and still in my studio.
Of course.
Yeah, here we go.
Throwing paint around. Probably a lot slower, but output might have slowed down quite a bit by then. But I still, that's what I want to do. You know, I don't want to sit at a desk and do something else, and we'll find any other hobbies. You know, I'm in too deep.
Really. I love that.
It's going to be a great news report where they're like, 100-year-old artist who for the past 50 years has been creating paintings of Ed Harris. Who found his claim to fame with his proclaimed Ed Harris series. And he's gonna be like, yeah, man, I was looking for my magnum opus, and then someone threw the idea of Ed Harris, I created it, and now I'm a millionaire.
I can't wait for this to happen. In fact, later, I'm going to try and paint Ed Harris and someone else there.
That's awesome. That's awesome. All right. Now we're at the extra fun part of our show. Jay? Cool.
Yeah, so we always end the show with the same segment, which we call Copy Collab Erase. So we're going to give you three artists. You're going to pick which one you would like to copy. You can, their style, their lifestyle, their type of art, anything, who you'd want to collaborate with, and then one artist has to go. Okay. And because, speaking to you, we jumped across the pond with our list today. So our artists are Damien Hirst, Nick Walker, and Tracy Eamon.
Ooh, I would collaborate with Tracy Eamon. Okay. And the reason is I like her paintings, not necessarily her more conceptual work, but her paintings, they're quite free, and it's a style I quite appreciate. And I couldn't do myself. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I would collaborate with her. I would probably copy. Oh, I see. They're all rays. This is really tough, actually, because... So I don't dislike Damien Hirst's work or Nick Walker's. I feel like, this is really hard. I'll probably copy Damien Hirst's work purely from a success standpoint.
Sure.
Because for me, both Nick Walker and Damien Hirst, I can see positives in both, but I think other artists do a better job of Nick Walker's style. So I'd erase his, which is really, really mean. Yeah.
Well, him as an active listener of this episode, you'll have to explain it to him later. So, James, you put together the list. What do you got?
I would copy Nick Walker. I like his style. I mentioned on the show before, I've met him before, he's a really nice guy. So
that makes me feel even worse.
I don't feel bad for James.
he took time out to just talk to me, which I think as an artist who's like famous, I was just like, this is, you don't have to be doing this. And I just, you know, obviously growing up in New York, but living in New York City, I saw his work around, and it was always just something that gravitated me toward his work. I would collaborate with Tracy. Again, I love her work. I think at some points you can feel, I guess, the energy that's probably there when she's making the work. And I think that would be cool to be around. And then, yeah, so Hearst has to go. Just because, I mean, I think he's a great artist. Some of the stuff I think he does is, like, I feel like there's some of his stuff just, there's a commercial aspect to it that just rubs me the wrong way.
Don't be mad that you didn't think about putting a shark in formaldehyde.
I think you hit that the nail on the head there. He's essentially just a businessman.
Yeah. Some of it, I'm just like, really, like, he's selling his name and not the work. I think it's just, I don't know, it rubs me the wrong way. Makes me feel icky.
I think that's part of the art.
Yeah.
It's to make you feel icky. Yeah.
Jose, are you ready?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I'm going to copy Nick just because I really like the style and sort of like the different mediums working outside, especially. But I want to collaborate with Damien Hirst instead of just copying him and like kind of just getting his success, which is kind of what I wanted to start. I was like, okay, I'm going to copy and be, but I really want to tap into his mind and his like a business mindset. So I think collaborating would be great because you can take his ridiculous, you know, business centric mindset, but then apply it to like my own work and my own ethos. So it's how I think we can create something new instead of just hashing out like what he's already done. So I think that could be pretty powerful. And then Tracy, I'm just the least familiar with the work. So I'd have to let it go.
All right. I am going to copy Damien Hirst, but not based on his success. I'm copying him based on his ability to be a multimedia artist and like how different each one of these pieces are, you know, whether it's an installation or it's a painting. I saw him, a video of him explaining some realistic paintings that he did, and I was absolutely blown away because for a while I was also thinking like, oh, this is, you know, if you're just putting stuff together, how artistic, how capable are you of being a multimedia artist until I seen him doing the, you know, explaining his realistic paintings that I was just blown away by because I for sure thought they were photos. And so I appreciate his ability. I'm going to collaborate with Eamon and probably for the same reason that Lee explained. That's not a style that I'm able to do, but I would love to be able to implement my style in addition to her paintings. And I'm going to erase Walker, and I'm not going to explain it until he hears the episode.
How dare you?
Oh, God.
He's such a nice guy.
Lee, we appreciate you taking the time. You know, thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for trusting us with getting insight into your life. And we wish you nothing but continued success.
Thanks for having me. It's been joyous. And it's also the first time I've been involved in a podcast. So, cool. Yeah, it was good. I'll do it again.
This was wonderful.
There we go.
How can people find you?
Twitter. At Leroy_Ellis or Instagram, Lee Ellis Art. I think that's about it, really.
We'll put those in the show notes as well.
Lee, I'm going to look for you on Tezos. I personally really enjoy Tezos, so I'm going to find you and I'm going to get something. And hopefully I'm going to get one of those drawings.
That was very threatening. I'm going to find you.
I'm going to find you.
Get it. I have a certain set of skills.
I think the same. Nice.
One Love Art Sessions couldn't have been complete without the wonderful guests and even more so, our wonderful community. And you, our listeners. We'd truly appreciate it if you took some time to rate and review the podcast. With your help, we could increase listenership and get these incredible stories and messages out to a greater audience. The music used in this podcast was created by Pound, aka Chris Lee. Thanks for listening. Subscribe. One Love.